I'm John.
And I'm Ron.
And I'm Jason. And this is Digital Divination on the No Direction Network.
All right, we are back for episode 143 of Digital Divination. How you doing, gentlemen?
I'm doing great.
Ron.
Hi, Jason.
How was the first week?
It's busy. It's anybody who has started a new job knows that onboarding always takes more time than you might think. Like training me on things that I should have known 3 years ago when I was at Paizo that I have since forgotten or unlearned. It's busy, but I am excited that so many people are excited to have me back and excited to sort of say hi or set up sort of just even quick Zoom calls on the side to say, hey, I'm happy to have you back. Let's chat. How have things been? It's great. Feels a lot like coming home.
I get to chat with you here in this instance. So that's why I didn't set up any Zoom.
Quite out, like you literally just did. Like, hey, checking in on my first week. Thanks, Jason. That's really sweet.
Yeah, no, but I didn't do it. I didn't do it this past week while we were
He's doing it on his own time rather than work time.
That's right.
My own time. I should put this on my timesheet.
That's how much I mean to you, Jason. That's sweet.
I had a very busy week as well.
What's that?
That was because Coco got sick, and we had a lot of like late nights and up at 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock in the morning a couple times, and taking her to the vet and bringing her back from the vet and taking her to the vet and bringing her back. It was like 3 days that lasted about 2 weeks, honestly. So, but she's feeling better now.
That's what I was going to ask. How are things going right now?
She's fine. She's pooping again.
Hooray! That's way better than the alternative.
Yeah. And so, you know, she pooped twice today, which is great, to get really into the nitty gritty. I won't get too detailed about what happened during all that time, but it was tiresome. And I missed some work basically because I was taking sick days, you know, sick hours and for all that. So I was there Monday to say, hey, and then it all went to heck. Luckily though, there was just enough downtime in that for us to record episode one of Intrepid Heroes Murder in Metal City, which I think went really well. What do you think, John?
I think so, and it's going to be out 3 days ago because this comes on Thursday.
Yes,
and it's being posted Monday, and it'll be both the podcast, which is on No Direction Network, but also for the first time we're recording video of that, which will be on YouTube under Intrepid Heroes. So we'll see. Yeah. My video editing skills.
If you're listening to this now, it's already out.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Our first, our session one.
Session one. I tell you, Ron.
Well, session zero session zero didn't have video.
Right.
That's right.
Okay.
So make sure you watch the go. And if you're normally an audio listener, go maybe watch the video, at least a little bit of it, because I did a little bit of dressing up, and Ron, I think I look pretty good. I took a picture and I'll show it to you later, but I think I look pretty darn good.
Alrighty. Yeah. I'm excited. All right. It's helpful for you to start out with this because when I watch this on YouTube when it comes out, just to see how silly I look, as I do almost every time we do one of these, I will then be reminded, if I haven't already, to go immediately watch the Murder in Metal City session one, because I can't right now while we're recording it, but I will be able to. Okay. Win. Thank you.
Yes. Yes. All right. So I just got this weekend, finally, my copy of the GM Core. Yeah. And I know that you two working for the company have access to it sooner. Mine got delayed for a couple weeks. Yes. I don't have a hard
copy.
Mine
is not physical. Mine is only electronic. Yeah.
You haven't been in the whole system long enough yet to get the packages.
Yeah. And then the physical ones takes you a while to get anyway, doesn't it? I mean, they don't. Sometimes, like you're like sometimes. The last people to get them usually.
Yes, subscribers get this stuff first. Customers generally get the stuff first.
That feels like an appropriate prioritization to me, especially because we get the digital much earlier.
We get the digital way early. Yeah, exactly.
Right. But given that we have it and it's hot off the presses, I thought that we could each share three things about the GM Core that we found interesting and we liked a lot.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We have at least that many.
Good.
At least that many.
Me too.
Yes. Good. Again, we talked about this a little bit. We each had a bunch, but we had to limit it to three. And we'll start with Jason talking about his first three, and then I'll go, and then Ron, you can bring us home.
You got it.
Okay, cool. I'll start easy because we just showed that cover, and the thing I want to kind of like briefly talk about is who the heck that is on the cover. If you don't know anything about the Starfinder setting, there is a bunch of bad guys called the Aslanti Star Empire. They're out there in the vast. They're away from everything, but they used to be, the Aslanti are sort of an ancient civilization that were on Galarian, but at some point they sent some people into space, and these are the sort of descendants of them, and they're terrible, awful fascists. They're the Empire, right? They're the sort of that kind of classic space bad guy. However, the Aslanti Star Empire was before now, quote unquote now, meaning when what this part of the timeline at GM Core was ruled by a pair of like twin brothers and sisters who were they were there. We never really kind of got into who they were, what they did, kind of stuff. But now they've been assassinated, and that's. That is the person who did it on the front cover, a religious figure named Ishmerai Ophir is now the ruler of the Aslanti Star Empire, and he's worse than the Exomander twins who used to rule the place, because now he's not only just like he's not only a fascist, he's also a religious zealot who wants to sort of take all the sort of like La Sala religion and continue to spread it along, and that's why he's created a new form of Aslanti Star Empire trooper called the Sahedron Guard, which have purple armor, sort of the classic green armor that we're used to. And so they're pretty cool. They're even worse. They made the Star Empire even worse, only probably because they're also in the process of fighting the Vescarium, and those two empires have got to battle it out. So we got to make the bad guys even worse so that the Vescarium doesn't seem so bad in comparison, because they were always kind of like, maybe a little too colonistic or whatever, just too militaristic for some people. But now their militarism is keeping the awful, awful Aslanti Star Empire at bay. So they don't have to affect the pack world. Oh, that can all spill into the pack worlds, or you can have a part of that in your campaign, of course. But like, yeah, I thought that was kind of a good sort of nice little change to sort of make things worse, but not like burning anything to the ground, kind of like, not getting rid of a bad guy, just kind of like bringing a bad guy into sharp focus so that we can sort of know, hey, yes, this is why we want to do it. Because the Aslanti Star Empire was good, it was always a bad guy, and it was always pretty focused as a bad guy, but like it was also sort of just because it's way out in nowhere, what's it doing, what's it up to, what's it like there. We, you know, against the Aeon Throne, AP sort of looks at that a little bit. We never go into it because it was never really about going into it and doing it or changing it. You're never about, you're never about to defeat the Aeon Throne, which is the sort of seat of power for the Aslanti Star Empire. You can't, because they have to be bad guys for a long time, essentially, right? So that's a sort of like a setting change. There's a lot of other sort of cool setting changes. There's, because it's the GM Core, it talks a lot about the setting. It goes into in-depth about each planet in the Pack Worlds, get a little spread of that. Not as much as the Pack Worlds book, but that was a whole book. This has got a bunch of other stuff in it too. It needs to go through. So it's just giving you sort of an overview and what's going on. What I like, just sort of tangentially for each of those sort of spots, there's a little notable events happening, recent events happening on Polonis. Here's what's going on. Yeah. Which is cool too. Then deep breath. Okay. Any questions about that, gentlemen? No.
I'm excited.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good.
So again, we're going to talk a little about some things. You're going to see that the GM Core Starfinder parentheses, and the GM Core parentheses Pathfinder have a lot in common. They have to. The systems are compatible. So a lot of this stuff, you know, about how much XP you get when you fight this kind of creature or this, that, and the other has to be the same, right? The treasure stuff is going to be slightly adjusted from being gold pieces to credits, values, whatever. But for the most part, you know, a lot of it's got to be the same.
Yeah, it would be weird if the victory point system between Pathfinder and the victory point system in Starfinder were different. That would be...
Right, exactly. Yeah. So that's why, like, there's a chunk in here in these subsystems, which I'm about to talk to about two of them now. There's my other two things that I liked that I thought were neat. Victory points and influence and research and chases and infiltration, all those subsystems are virtually the same. Mathematically, they're the same. Rules-wise, they are the same. There might be the examples they give are different, obviously, right. Because you want to have a different library in the Starfinder Core than in the Pathfinder GM Core. But there's two new sort of subsystems that are kind of cool, kind of neat, and definitely make things, you know, definitely give it Starfinder its own identity. And I'll start with the first one, which is the hacking subsystem.
Right.
It is a way to make hacking a little more dynamic if you want it. Now, the advice in here is, of course, says that, hey, if you want to hack a simple computer, like picking a simple lock, you just use the action, the computer's action to do it. And it takes two actions and you get into, you know, or whatever you need to do. This is a little bit more like mixes the infiltration system a little bit in with hacking, so that there are things that you can do to make it more of a team effort, and that so it being an entire thing instead of it just being sort of hack this computer. Yes, you're in. Oh no, this is a very important computer you need to hack into. It's got different points of access, and you might get different information out of it depending on how you get to it. And each of those points of access has countermeasures involved that might happen when you fail those checks to do that. Right. So every sort of, you know, as usual, it turns the computer into sort of a stat block, like a research library stat block or a hazard stat block or an influence stat block, right? And those are all sort of there to help keep it sort of like nice and contained. And it's cool because it's not only, but it's a stat block that doesn't necessarily have like one thing. It's got like, they're all going to be different from each other a lot of ways, but each part is going to be like have like what the vulnerabilities of that point of access are and what the countermeasures are. And whatnot. For instance, just to sort of, that's all very sort of generalized. So let me give you a little specific, is that one of the computers you can hack in here is a Zoe Media server. You want to get into the Zoe Media's, one of Zoe's servers. How do you get into it? Well, you can do two things. You can try to hack into Zoe's personal account. And the way that you might do that is that, you know, you can... So that requires a computer check, obviously, but the vulnerabilities are like using other skills to sort of like guess his password, right? Or call the assistant and pretend to be Zoe and try to get the password from them.
Some social engineering, that's one of the classic hacking paths. Yep.
Exactly. Right. So that's going to be like a deception or a diplomacy check, right? Just sort of trying to steal Zoe's comm unit and then using that to hack the thing. That's going to be a thievery check. So there's lots of different ways, and they aren't necessarily happening like right there at the computer. That's just, it's taking a sort of broad overview of how hacking can work in that sort of, as in comparison to the real world. You can do it through the computer. You can do it using social engineering, phishing, you know, that kind of stuff. Like, and the other sort of thing, like look for a back door to the server. That's one way you can look at it. And the vulnerabilities are, you know, like programming something or bribing a server admin, you know, finding them in a bar and offering them money for that backdoor access. So it's all pretty cool. It's basically sort of like a nice, tidy way to kind of like write all, oftentimes in an adventure, say, you'll write all that out in paragraph form. And it'll just be like, hey, the PCs have got to get into this, find this file. There's like four different ways they can do this. They can do this. They can do, you know, they can ask for the admin password. They can bribe an admin server. And you have to like take each of those accounts. And that takes up space. This kind of like condenses it in a way that makes it obvious what it is, but also take less words, fewer words. And I think that's pretty cool and pretty neat. And there's a whole list of sort of like sample vulnerabilities and countermeasures here and a big sidebar for making your own. All great. And then you just have it use the DCs that are, you know, standard for the level of whatever it is you're going for. Most likely, you know, this Zoe Media Server is like, says it's a level 4 computer, so you'll probably be going up against it when you're like level 2 or even level 3. Whereas what I also thought was funny too in this, the other example is that an Abadar Core customer account is a level 13 hacking challenge because Abadar Core has got that stuff locked down.
All they don't locked want down.
The customers' information getting out right easily. So that's that one. It's like that's like 4 pages it gets in through it. So it's so concise. That's the kind of thing that I love when things are concise enough that you can sort of basically spin it out into a scene or two. And that might be half an hour, 45 minutes of a scene that you're like, what do you want to do? How do you want to help? And how are you going to get some information, right? It's great. Fun. Similarly, the other subsystem that's introduced here is the cinematic Starship scenes subsystem. Now, notice it's not cinematic Starship combat, and I'll get to that why that isn't exactly. But again, it is another way to sort of like take the Starship stuff that's very important to Starfinder and sort of boil it down to kind of like a nice sort of like influence hazard chasey kind of stat block and be able to run it in a way that's not necessarily using different skills, changing up a map to a hex grid, you know, that kind of stuff. Which isn't to say that, you know, tactical Starship combat isn't going to be interesting. Sure, but they're going to come up with something that's going to be fun. But this is just a nice little way to kind of like, what is it? What does he do when you want to focus on doing something with the Starship that is less, that is more complex than just like, oh, you're just flying through here. Or you chart a course through the drift and you get to where you're going, right? What if something's happening? What if there is a fight, but one of these are fights? What if it's something like, I need to scan this nebula, that, but other things can happen while that's going on, right? Like, you know, in a way, like a researching a library, right?
How do you compare this with the narrative Starship combat that came out near the end of Starfinder First Edition?
Yeah, good question. You know, the guy who wrote that did it completely different, right?
They are completely different. Narrative Starship combat, now I'm going to refresh my memory. I should have looked that up again because I was thinking about it. Narrative Starship combat was sort of mostly about combat, but it was sort of like picking like it was a way to sort of like take the tactical stuff and sort of take a lot of these gritty turn-based decisions out of it and just be like, well, what do you want to do for the next 5 minutes? What do? Are you threatening them with your, you know, as the tough leader of this tough captain of this Starship? Are you going down and just boosting the power? Or are you doing something weird with your magic? You know, because it was basically like, use the skill, go for it, whatever you want to do. And the GM sets a DC. It was very loosey-goosey. This is in the Pathfinder 2E vein, a little less loosey-goosey, but still like you can make fun decisions, right? Like, the way the stat block works, you know, it has literally a victory condition on there and then things you can do and objectives and additional objectives and roles. And so it's all sort of, you know, looking at the description of the stat block, it all sort of spells it out. And what do you need to do? This is a little more longer because you have to think about what Starships the players might be in, if they're in different ones or what have you. But then, you know, it's not just like always like win, defeat a threat. It could be just gathering up some type of victory points or something like that. To sort of, again, the three, they gave you three and they give you good, three examples. One of them is sort of an ambush. You're getting ambushed while you're doing asteroid stuff. And you know, what you can do here is you can shoot the gun and that gives it like what that does and how much, what damage it would do. So that it does kind of get into some nitty gritty, like you might be with a tactical Starship combat, but you also are just like shooting asteroids or trying to outrun these corpse fleet ambushers or something else, right? Or like literally like repairing the Starship while it's getting damaged. A lot in here that you can do. But more interesting is that the second example is scanning a dying sun. Like that's stuff, you know, but also things are happening. Maybe there's a, you know, supernova, you know, solar flares going off. So you have to make sure the ship doesn't get damaged or rally the crew if something's happening. And then, oh no, look, a group of fire elementals comes out of the sun. And now you've got to deal with that because they're attacking the Starship, you know. So they're all kind of like, you know, vaguely, they are not necessarily battles, but they are kind of have a lot of the examples have a little battle flavor to them, you know, more or less.
And all realistic things you would do to move the narrative forward when you're in the ship. Yes. That's
yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So these kind of focus, yeah, and if you read them, they read a little bit like complex hazards with stuff sort of mixed in with them, because like it says what the threat routine, like, you know, the complex hazard, a complex hazard has a routine and how many every time you do it. So every round that goes by, and rounds are not necessarily the same 6 seconds, but it does sort of give you the advice about like what you're doing, what the players can do in terms of like, with their abilities themselves. Is it in here? Yeah, like character abilities, it talks about that. What, you know, starships can get conditions, maybe, you know. It's all pretty neat. I haven't like fully dug into it. I just kind of skimmed it a bit for this. But I am really interested in seeing how that plays out in, you know, in adventures, and how it plays out on the table. Because there, you know, we get stuff, you know, I all the time when I run a Pathfinder 2E chase, for instance, I'm like, okay, you're gonna run this part. And here's some things you can maybe do. And I went 9 times out of 10, at least one player will be like, can I use my thievery here? I'm like, what? What do you want to do exactly? You know, this is running away from cows. Oh, I want to quickly make a lasso with thievery. I'm like, yeah, cool, whatever. Like, you know, these are good guidelines, and that's sort of the but, right. You know, people will want to do other things, but at least with these guidelines, you now have the flexibility. That's, I mean, this is generally the thing about the Pathfinder Starfinder system, is that like, there's enough guardrails that I know what I'm doing when I'm improvising. And that's one of the things I love about it. So I can easily improvise off of something like this, even, you know, even if this sort of scene stat block is like almost two columns long, it's definitely got enough in there, and people can be that, and I can be like, well, you're doing that, but I'm in my head, it's, you're actually doing this thing, and that's how it's going to react to, you know? So three things I like. Again, there's a lot to love in this, because, you know, it's in there. It's all in there. It's all the things you need. It's helping you run Starfinder better, and it's a good 80 pages shorter than Pathfinder GM Core, because it doesn't have to be chock full of magic items.
Right.
The end. Thank you. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
Right. Your Jason Talk.
All right. So
I changed my name to Ted.
I'm going to kind of bounce off some things there that are somewhat related, I'll say, in that things that are in here that maybe aren't in Pathfinder GM Core. And one in particular is Chapter 5 on
anachronistic adventures. I always in my head pronounce it anachronistic.
Anachronistic adventures. So the idea that because Pathfinder and Starfinder are fully compatible in terms of the rule set, you can mix and match the players in the settings. And so they kind of give some guidelines on how to do that with this chapter. And so it's more than a couple pages. It's probably 10 pages or whatever. It does a couple things. The first thing it does, it talks about types of adjustments that you might have to make between the two when you're going either taking Starfinder characters and putting them in to a Pathfinder setting, or Pathfinder characters and putting them into a Starfinder setting. So, for example, if you're bringing Starfinder characters into Pathfinder, one of the issues becomes, you know, the equipment they have, the futuristic equipment, is very rare. And in terms of charging it up or making ammunition and stuff like that, there's not a real means to do that unless they can bring something or make something on their own. So it adds kind of a whole additional layer to the type of things that you would have to do in addition to just playing your characters, just kind of surviving that. Similarly, it talks about if you bring Pathfinder characters into Starfinder, although there might be certain things that are applicable, they might, the players themselves might want to make a change to their characters to fit into the new setting. And so the chapter gives some advice on, you know, how you might allow players to make a one-time adjustment in order to fit in. So there's, you know, obviously there's some different, there's computers and piloting skills in Starfinder that aren't available in Pathfinder. So maybe if they had, vehicle lore of some sort, that then it might allow them to transfer it over to piloting and things like that. So it kind of gives, you know, those sorts of guidelines and some examples of how you might, you know, have time shifted adventures, you know, in terms of what brings them there, how they might have to adapt as part of the adventure and things like that, differences in classes and backgrounds and things like that, you know, how you would take like an alchemist, you know, is using bombs. Well, maybe in Starfighter, well, that becomes grenades. Inventors, you know, who have, you know, their
steampunk.
The steampunk stuff now becomes more technological, things like that. And what's interesting, you know, Jason mentioned our Murder in Metal City podcast. We have an investigator in our Starfinder campaign.
So it's pulled Tim, right in from the Pathfinder class.
Yes, decided to bring it in. And I'm really curious to see how that's going to kind of go play in there, you know?
Yeah, I should definitely read this like spread or two because, like you said, like Tim's playing an investigator. He's not playing a time-shifted character. He's just using the investigator class and then everything else, Starfinder.
Right, so basically, you know, adapting it to Starfinder with that that kind of set. And because there's so many options that you have in Pathfinder already, I think that makes like an interesting way to diversify your classes and archetypes actually as well in Starfinder. So one of the things I'm working on right now for Legendary Games is converting some Starfinder first edition stuff over to Starfinder second edition. And I'm actually drawing from some archetypes in the Pathfinder to bring them in order to build out the things that were added basically, you know, and so one of the things I was thinking of that would be really fun is like adding like a kineticist archetype into Starfinder.
To reflect some elemental powers like that.
Yeah. So I think, you know, so different things like that. So I thought that'd be, you know, be a lot of fun. Anyway, so this chapter talks about a lot of things you can do, you know, with technology and crafting and skill checks and downtime, ancestries, background. So it really gives you a lot of stuff in that. And it talks about time travel itself. So some of the risks of time travel and things like that. So, using the gap as a plot device to, that supernaturally alters or censors sensitive information that a time traveler might actually have. So I thought that was kind of interesting there, and talking about gods and deities might actually intervene in those cases as well. And then it gives examples for specific adventure hooks and things you can do. And it goes into talking about how to deal with creatures as well and things like that. So there's a lot. It devoted a lot in this book to the compatibility issue. All right. So shifting gears a little bit, I'm going to talk about afflictions in here. Obviously, there were afflictions already in Pathfinder Second Edition, and you had some in Starfinder First Edition. The afflictions that they came up with for Second Edition are just really cool, you know. So and they have broken down by curses and diseases and things like that. And I'm just going to read you some of the titles of these things because they just look like they would have been so much fun to make these things. So, you know, for curses, they have social media addiction, eternal busyness, you know, so the side effect of an eternally busy carbonated drink that causes all foreign liquids to bubble out of control and makes a challenge for you to be hydrated. Microtransaction.
Kind of Willy Wonka problem,
you stole fizzy lifting drinks.
Fizzy lifting drinks, yep.
Yeah, microtransaction hell.
That was a fun one.
Yeah, I thought that was a bullet magnet. We were talking about this curses your causes your body to generate a powerful magnetic field in the presence of high kinetic projectiles. Ron, I'm sure you'll like this one. Non-disclosure agreement.
What a curse! The curse of the NDA.
Yes.
Right.
Trust exercise. So those, I mean, those are some.
Why is that? Why is that one's 15th level?
I don't know. It's really high. It causes you to trust everyone and do what you think is that everyone's going to be doing what you think is best for you, which is kind of crazy.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. Like a super charm curse. Diseases, they have transmittable.
Tinnitus.
Tinnitus, yeah.
Tinnitus, yeah.
I have it, but Ron, you know all about tinnitus, I'm sure.
Imagine you could give that to someone else.
Yeah. Some of these aren't as fun. Cackle fever, mind fire. These are kind of reminiscent. Yeah,
those actually come back or show up in Pathfinder. They've been diseases in the game for a long time. Yeah.
Right. Some of these are coming over. Stardust plague is a little bit different. You have a whole bunch of radiation sickness, which is nice. I mean, it's not nice to have, but it's nice to break it down to severe, extreme, incredible. Now, they don't have gamma radiation sickness. That's one they should have.
Give you Hulk powers.
That would be a fun one, you know? So I'll have to think about that one. So anyway, so I thought these were, some of these were a lot of fun. And then the last one I want to talk about are the hazards here. And again, they have kind of the basic guidelines from Pathfinder. Second edition for detecting and triggering and disarming and stuff like that. And I like the detail that they have on here compared to what we had for Starfinder first edition to really kind of explain these things. Then they have a lot of really cool examples of hazards. So anti-gravity pulse, caustic nectar spray, cryo mist. That's that one we had it. There was a custom hazard I made of cryo mist before in Starfinder first edition at high level like this. Jolting console, exploding egg sac, laser web is pretty common. Haywire robotic arm, monument to the devourer. Mm-hmm. So that kind of makes sense. It might be something related to the devourer. Psychotropic spores, mutation fog, repulsing force field, traumatic moment, soul upload, tranquilize a dart trap. That's pretty standard. Temporal rift, talking about time travel issues. Deadly vid game. So you kind of, it's a hyper realistic vid game that pulls a player into a virtual world, transforming them into a pixelated avatars. You know, it's like that game, the movie Pixels. Know kind of thing. Then getting into complex hazards.
Hold on a second. Deadly vid game. Someone gets pulled into a computer world, and your prime example is the movie Pixels and not the movie Tron.
Okay. Well, I was saying Pixels. Okay, fine. I didn't like Tron, okay? But you're right.
Whoa, okay.
This podcast is over.
It is. Well, I didn't like Tron, the video game. And I don't think I'm going to like Tron that comes out.
I'm so looking forward to the new Tron coming out, Ares. I am very excited about that.
Right. That was a bad example of that. So, I apologize.
Pixels.
Yeah, I get called out. Well, that's the first thing that came to mind when I saw Pixels.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Okay. Got pixels in it, at least.
This is the first time I didn't even notice this hazard before. And I thought, this is really cool. All right. Oh, complex hazards. Right. Collapsing building, disintegration chamber. So these are really, they are super sci-fi kind of things here. One of them that we encountered already in our Devastation arc, a quantum clone hazard.
That was
basically they make an exact duplicate of you, and where each of you think you're the real one, which is kind of scary. And of course,
and the one with the goatee is the evil one.
Oh, yes, and the reactor meltdown, of course. You got to have the Star Trek moment. So, anyway,
and trash compactor,
and the trash compactor, yes, the Star Wars moment to go with that as well. And that's only a level 6 hazard. Shoot, that's pretty low.
Yeah.
Yeah, so your low-level characters can have that.
Trash compactor.
Yeah. Room.
All right, so those were kind of the three things that I thought had some interesting differences between the GM core and the Starfinder core, given the compatibility things. It's nice to see these kind of really fun skinnings for things.
Yeah, very much so. Well, let me jump in with my three. One of the first things I wanted to take a look at was, comes right after the Afflictions chapter, is the Environment chapter. Not because it's the only chapter name that has the word Ron in the middle of it, but Environment is a thing that I take a look at because it creates the environment section of any game, frankly, is the building blocks for what you need to help set the scene or sort of exciting encounters within the game. I was really excited with all of the variety in the Pathfinder GM core. And it was really neat to see so many more things added to the environmental features in the Starfinder GM core. Some of the things that were in Pathfinder that you don't see here, which is no surprise, are things like stalactites, stalagmites, and undergrowth, and things like that. But you have so much more from a sci-fi perspective, from acid rain to decompression and airlocks and psi storms and things like that. This feels like a really neat toolbox for GMs to be able to use to sort of put super cool environments together. So that was the first thing that I noticed. The second thing I noticed, which was a little bit of a gee whiz for me, but also a really fun piece for me to see, is the section on the plains. Now, the whole chapter is called the Pack Worlds. I think that's sort of the general catch-all term for this is the game setting. But the last couple chapters of that get far away from the Pack Worlds, and I thought it was interesting that there is only they devote only a couple of pages to Near Space. There's going to be a lot more set out there. We've already seen a ton about it. I'm sure there's going to be a ton of adventure set there. Only 2 pages to the Vast, which has, I think, even more stuff going on in it, even weirder stuff out there.
Yeah.
And then they give even bigger, 10 pages to the Plains. And now a lot of this is stuff from the Plains that we saw in the Pathfinder GM core.
Right.
But I think it's significant that the Starfinder GM core is devoting so much of its real estate saying, look, here's all the outer planes and how the universe that you know of fits in it. And there's a couple of good reasons for that. One, there are a lot of rules for each of them to make sure they feel different in play. But also there's sort of a lot of interlocking nature of the planes, not just with each other, but with what the players can do, because you could have like a devil or a demon show up any place, but the Near Space or the Vast, that's going to be a setting that, like, as a GM, you send people to. So maybe some more information about the planes than those two things is warranted here in this book. I feel like that's actually an interesting choice. And I feel like it says something about the wondrous nature of Starfinder as a game. So I thought that was actually really cool. They go into a lot of details about that. And then speaking of the wondrous nature, I also had my eyes fall upon page 203, which was at the end of the religion section, where it talks about the faiths and philosophies. We've seen some of this before, where it talks about the green faith and the prophecies of Palestrade, things like that. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really cool that they've got a... they treat these like the religions, and that they now have edicts and anathema with them. So even if you are an atheist, what are things that atheism does and what are things that it does not do? And then it's really tied into the lore with the battle saints of Demoritash, right? That's the Vesk thing, the cycle that connects so much with the Kasathas and the Solarians, the Song of Silence, which I think is a really neat expansion from the Whispering Way. And then a lot of these other sort of faiths and philosophies, it feels like they are providing as thorough information for people who want to be religious in a different way than following a specific deity. And I thought that was really cool to see so much of that. I think I went through my three too fast, but that's three.
I'm looking forward to when we get a couple pantheons in Starfinder Second Edition. Yep. Something that was made a little more crunchy in Divine Mysteries, pantheons and covenants and stuff like that. And it'd be great to see some of these and start what we're going to get exactly. What is the pantheon that worships, you know, Hylax and a couple other minor bug gods, right? You know, is there a pantheon of just bugs?
Right.
Yeah.
When that becomes an interesting, because you can have a really multifaceted religious view with your character. One of the things that pantheons has really added that I really like is exactly that. You feel like you're not just, I'm the one that follows a Yomade and that's it, right? But, oh, how does this fit into the other? How does this fit in not only with the other deities, maybe with my different factions that play on each other in a more cohesive belief system? That's really cool.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, when there was more, when people were worshiping more than one god, they did have pantheons. They worshiped the pantheon, not just like Zeus, right? It was the Greek. And when you do that as in a game system, you want to have game stuff attached to just that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Can I give you my two runners up? My two
sure
honorable mentions.
Yeah.
My two honorable mentions are Forklift. Hey.
As a vehicle?
Forklift. As a vehicle. Forklift okay. as a vehicle. Just stats for Forklift. Hilarious. And then this guy on page 258 in the gloss decks is this this what's probably Silicon Mummy from Calistrade who's failed whatever it's called now, I can't remember what it's called, that when you upload your consciousness into a computer so you don't have to go to an afterlife. And then they wake up. Yeah. And, no, my body, it's completely silicone and stuff. Arr.
All right. So, Ron, did you have any that honorable actually, mentions? And
then, well, that brings up, no, I just want to point out to our viewers, that brings us full circle, because when we got together to sort of talk about this ahead of time, that was literally the first thing that Jason brought up to us was, look at this cool picture, guys.
Look at this guy. He's a real creep.
Well, you also, I don't know if you pointed this out, that the cybernetic dragon on 251.
Oh, yeah. The diabolic dragon with cybernetics.
That is just crazy.
So good looking.
Yeah. It's got a rotary laser on its back.
Anachronistic Adventures part where you're like, take a diabolic dragon.
That is really neat.
Yeah. Give it a Gatling laser.
Yeah.
Dear God.
No.
Or not anyway, God.
Yes. It's interesting that although there's overlap between the GM core for Starfinder and the GM core for Pathfinder, there's the flavoring that they put because of the difference in the setting.
Yeah.
It's just wonderful. You know, I just really like
very strong
all the work that was put into it. You can tell even though the organization is the same, it is like it's completely different books, different takes on things. Really nice to
totally different to see. Feel.
Yeah, the compatibility, but also the uniqueness for that.
Yeah, and so, you know, hey, those people who are just like coming to, like, just coming for Starfinder now have the complete package all at their fingertips, don't necessarily have to be like picking. Well, until, you know, Alien Core comes out, then they'll have the full complete package, but
the full, that's right. first three right. books.
That's coming soon. Yeah, the first.
But this was nice that this came, you know, a month after the player core. I mean, it came pretty quick, you know, timing wise. I don't know how fast that was on the Pathfinder remastered side, but this was pretty quick, I thought.
I don't know.
Go back and look.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
It was a whole different company then.
Yeah. You don't know any of this history. So. Well, I'm John.
And I'm Ron.
And I'm Jason, and this has been Digital Divination.